Welcome to Inside Personal Growth Podcast. Deep dive with us as we unlock the secrets to personal development, empowering you to thrive. Here, growth isn't just a goal, it's a journey. Tune in, transform, and take your life to the next level by listening to just one of our podcasts. Hey, well, welcome back to Inside Personal Growth. This is Greg Voisin, the host of Inside Personal Growth. And, you know, Scott, this is Scott Young joining us from Vancouver. Scott, say hi.
Hi, everybody. Oh, yes. Thank you for having me.
I always enjoy having returning author guests. Now, Scott reached out to about his new book, which we're going to be talking about here in a second. But I want to mention to my audience, and we'll put in the show notes, Scott was on this podcast for podcast 742, which is about 400 podcasts ago, for a book called Ultra Learning, Master Hard Skills, Outsmart the Competition and Accelerate Your Career with Scott Young. He got lots of good play on that particular one. And I know we will on this one as well. So I want my listeners to know about that, Scott. So we'll put a link to that as well. Do you have a copy of the book there with you today that you can hold up, the new book?
The new book, no. Unfortunately,
no.
They're
okay.
Real close. So we're recording this about 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the book's due, and my copies are set to arrive Friday. I would love nothing more than to hold a physical one in my hand and show it to you.
Okay.
I was chastising the publishers about not having one ready for me, but they will be ready by the time this airs. So you'll have to use AI to digitally insert one in my hand.
All right, will do. Well, that will be there. That's for certain. We will have it on the screen for everybody. But I'm going to let them know a little bit, very little bit about you, but most importantly about this book. You are a Wall Street Journal bestselling author, as I said, of a book called Ultra Learning. He's got a podcast host. He's a computer programmer and avid reader. And in 2006, he's published weekly essays to help people learn and think better. His work has been featured in the New York Times Pocket and Business Insider, on the BBC, and at TEDx, among other outlets. He says that he doesn't promise to have all the answers, just a place to start. And as I said, he lives in Vancouver. And for all of you who are trying to guess at this point, the new book is called Get Better at Anything. That's the book that we're speaking about. And if you go to his website, and that's Scott H. Young, there's got to put the H in there, YOUNG.com. There you can learn more about the book. You can learn more about Scott. And you can learn more about getting better at anything. Also, Scott has teamed up with Cal Newport, who's been on the show. And they did a program, it's a learning course, and we'll put a link to that as well, called Life of Focus. It's really fascinating. And I think this whole thing revolves around people really learning how to focus and how to move distraction out of their life. And that brings me to kind of your introduction concepts and getting better at anything, Scott. And in the book, you talk about three factors for getting better at anything: see, do, and feedback. Can you briefly explain how these factors interact and why they're critical to mastery?
Yeah. So these three factors, I mean, it sounds very simple, but they're sort of a shorthand for this like immense body of research that I was trying to cover in the book. And see is coming from the idea that most of what we know comes from other people. Most of the knowledge that we have, the skills we have, we acquire from learning and studying from other people. And so really the amount of creativity and problem solving we have is really the tip of a much larger iceberg of knowledge that we acquire from people that we know. And so the thing that I talk about in the book is that the ease at which we can learn from other people, if the environment that you're in enables you to learn from other people more easily, that can make a huge difference, not just in your ability, but the ability of an entire field to progress. So I start off with this example, a little bit of a fun example of Tetris players, where in the beginning of the game, when people were fairly disconnected from each other, the actual proficiency people reached was not that high. Whereas now you have like 12-year-old kids, 13-year-old kids just doing things that are incredible. And it's because the internet has enabled them to learn from each other. Do is the idea that, of course, to get better at things, we need practice, but not just any kind of practice. You need the right kind of practice. So I cover in the book a lot of research about what does practice help with and what are the ways that sometimes our own brains get in the way that we try to do things for practice that make it easier on ourselves that actually hinders our own growth. And then finally, feedback, the ability to learn from our mistakes, to learn from corrections, to learn from interacting with the environment. And so I cover some of the research in there showing about how necessary feedback is for getting real mastery or real proficiency in many fields.
What's interesting, your personal background is you were going to college, I think, where I read somewhere.
Yeah.
And then you gave it up because you wanted to pursue this whole area around learning. I think it might be interesting for our listeners to know a little bit about your journey because
right.
you really have an interesting one. It wasn't like this typical guy that graduates from Harvard and says, hey, you, I'm this you know, knowledgeable guy or from Stanford or something like that. You took an unfamiliar path to getting here.
Sure.
Can you tell the listeners a bit about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I mean, anyone who can go back and wants to listen to the show we did about ultra learning, I've certainly talked about it more then. So for me, I went to school, I graduated. I did go through college and graduate with a business degree. And I graduated, and like a lot of people, I felt like I studied the wrong subject. I thought that I wanted to study business, but I really felt like technology, the world of programming, this kind of thing, was the future. I was doing stuff online already. I wanted to know more about it, but I didn't want to go back to school. So I did a project. This was sort of the first thing that brought me some internet attention, internet fame. Was a project I called the MIT Challenge, which was learning MIT's four-year computer science curriculum over 12 months. So this was a project that I did now over 10 years ago. So I'm really dating myself. This was something I did in my early 20s. And it was the start of really an obsession about learning. So I did a project after that, learning multiple languages. It was a project we called The Year Without English. A friend and I, we traveled around the world for a year, only speaking the language of the country we were in, and learned a bit of Spanish, Portuguese, Mandarin Chinese, and some Korean. And I've since done projects for quantum mechanics and portrait drawing and all sorts of other stuff. And really over the last, I would say maybe 5 to 6 years, sort of starting with ultra learning and really since ultra learning, I've been doing like this intensive deep dive into the science of learning itself. And so I think that really culminates in this book where, you know, it's not just my personal experiences, but really trying to give the reader a bird's eye view of everything that scientists have discovered over the last, you know, up to a century really of research on how we learn, how we acquire skills, what enables that, and what holds us back. And, you know, it's a complicated area. There's lots of contention and debate still, but I think if you can appreciate the broad strokes of that, it's very helpful for you in trying to get better at what you want to get better at.
Most certainly. Yeah. Now, you know, you're talking about how we learn and how you immersed yourself in learning based on what you just said, going to a country and only being able to speak in that language. You talked about the MIT project that you did. You talked about Tetris already and how these kids are like mastering Tetris. And I think from the outside looking in sometimes to people, when you talk about it, it's simple. It looks a lot simpler than it really is. Let's put it that way. You mentioned that most of what we know comes from other people.
Yeah.
How can someone effectively discern which influences or mentors to follow when trying to kind of improve in a specific area? Because there's so many people out there when you look at the millions of YouTube videos where we can learn from, right? There's all these various programs now, like this Reflect note-taking one, the second brain guy who's telling, you know, how to do, you know, those kind of things.
And yeah, Tiago Forte.
Tiago, right? And you probably know Tiago.
Yeah.
And all of, right. And all of it's designed to get us to a point where we can be more effective, while at the same time, more creative. more innovative, more ways to think in unique, and I'm going to say remarkable ways. How do we discern from these people that we really should be following and mentors? Tiago would be one of them, right? It's like, okay, I'm going to get my second brain. I'm going to follow Tiago, right?
Right.
And the reality is how much of that para, P-A-R-A, are we really using?
Yeah. I mean, I think, so the C component that I talk about in the book, I think it's more fundamental than that. So obviously there's people like me and yourself and Tiago that kind of sit in this ecosystem, and we are kind of advice givers. So we sort of sit above the specific details of your job, your life, your skill, and try to give broad advice. Like, I'm writing a book that's about learning kind of in general. It's not about, you know, how to become a really good JavaScript programmer or how to, you know, become a really good portrait painter. But in reality, like, what we need when we're actually improving is a lot of fairly specific information. And so I think the advice givers and people like Tiago and myself, we have an important role in nudging people in the right direction of offering tools and strategies. But I think what I'm really trying to express in this book of this C idea is the very detailed, specific kind of nitty gritty information for particular skills. That's so important. And so, you know, using this Tetris example, it wasn't just that, you know, people had some broad general ideas about, okay, how to practice that weren't available. It was like super specific techniques, like how do you hold your finger on the button so that you can make it, you know, move fast enough so you can move these pieces at these high levels. Like, this is super specific stuff to Tetris. And similarly, you know, even as an author right now, like, I'm part of a network of other authors, and people are talking about like hyper specific things, like about publishing contracts and like who to publish with and how you can set up certain deals and stuff. These are not relevant to other fields, but if you don't have that knowledge, if you're sort of in the outs on the book publishing industry, you don't know that, you're going to have a harder time breaking in. And so this C idea is about how you can get immersed in networks of people who have quite detailed knowledge about the thing that you're trying to get good at, whether that's your career or your hobby or just a subject you want to do, so that you can acquire that from other people. And how, you know, really, if you are in the right environments, the right workplaces, the right places, that's going to be facilitated a lot more, and it's going to affect how you are able to get better at things.
Well, let's face it. You and I are living in a world now that's being heavily influenced by artificial intelligence. Matter of fact, my son's master degree from UC Irvine was in AI, and he now is an executive at Adobe. And as we see companies like Adobe being able to create images right online that, you know, you just tell it what you want, it pops up some kind of image, or people writing books fully using AI or doing research. Where do you believe, as somebody who's in getting better at anything? I brought this up to my wife because, you know, we were discussing this morning about our human knowledge versus our machine learning.
Yeah.
And where do you actually see this intersection? Because it's an interesting topic to talk about. Are we really headed to the point in business and in our personal lives where we're going to go to ChatGPT or some other, you know, generative AI situation and start pulling all of our facts and relying on them?
Yeah, I mean, it's wild times. I've been working on this book for a number of years, and ChatGPT, and well, really the GPT that came before it, but also ChatGPT, I think it just blew people away. I mean, I think if you go back a decade, no one's really predicting this. No one's thinking, oh, well, you just, you know, give a specific type of machine learning model the entire text of the internet, and it can have like human-sounded conversations that you would do all these sorts of things. So I think this failure of prediction should be humbling for people, pundits like me, or but even experts who are, you know, eminent in their field about making predictions about like what's going to happen 10, 20 years from now. So I won't say what I think is going to be the case with ChatGPT or large language models or whatever comes next. But what I will say is that if you look at kind of the history of technology, you see this pattern of new technologies coming up that replace some human cognitive labor. And when the technology is first developed, people are very much fixated on the substitution effect, the idea that this new technology can replace things that previously were only done by human minds. But what's often ignored or is really unknown is the complementary effect that by creating that new technology, it opens up new vistas of cognitive potential that wasn't there before. So I'll give a really simple example. So when we go back to ancient Greece, Socrates is decrying the invention of a very pernicious technology that was going to rob human ingenuity and effort, which was paper. Because before, if you know, you weren't writing things down, you had to memorize speeches, you had to memorize this oral transmission, this human knowledge, and now you have paper, you can just write it down, you don't actually have to exercise that faculty of memory. And Socrates is saying this is a bad thing, we're going to lose our ability to memorize things, which was so important for knowledge transmission back then. And the funny thing is, you can look at that as being kind of quaint, but he was actually right. If you go back to the ancient Greeks, they had these like elaborate mnemonic systems for memorizing huge amounts of information because of this need for an oral transmission. And we don't do that anymore. We, you know, we write things down and we remember it poorly and we look it up when we have to. But what he was focusing on was the substitution, that there was this human cognitive ability of memory palaces and mnemonic techniques for memorizing, you know, long speeches, things like the Iliad and the Odyssey that were going to be replaced by paper. But what he was ignorant of and wasn't aware of was how, well, once you're able to write things down, the amount of knowledge that you can have, the amount of knowledge that can be built up in a culture, in a society, just grows exponentially. Yeah. And so now, you know, the idea that you would memorize all human knowledge is just ridiculous. That's a fantasy. You can't even read all of it, right? And so we are much better off as a society. And the cognitive demands on people are actually much higher because of this new opportunity. And so when I think about things like ChatGPT, I think about, you know, there's been some recent studies that show that, for instance, with programmers who have large language models, it's the weaker programmers that do better because they're able to perform at a higher level, whereas the expert programmers don't really use the LLMs that much. But again, this is focusing on the substitute effect. This is focusing on, well, in the short term, where no one's really familiar with these tools and knows how to use them and is, you know, they haven't really integrated themselves into our lives, it's the people who don't really know that much to get most of the advantage of these large language models. But in the long term, it's hard to say. It's hard to say because who knows what kinds of, you know, feats of intellectual prowess, things with knowledge, creativity are going to be generated in the wake of, you know, these tools being widely available. And so I'm actually kind of excited because I think far from robbing, you know, human ingenuity and creativity, it's going to be a totally new terrain where there's going to be new skills and professions that didn't exist 10 years ago as a result.
Well, I personally believe it can take many mundane tasks that we perform and open our minds up for much more creative things that we do, like, it, you know, writing a contract or something like that, or getting an outline for a PowerPoint or something, where the true creativity goes into what is now in that PowerPoint, right? And how I evolve it and how I make it better. I think it's just going to allow us to keep making things better and better. That's my personal humble opinion of that. Yeah. And that brings me to, you talk about self-education, because it's like, okay, we've got this brain that weighs 3 or 4 pounds in our skull, and the neurotransmitters are firing and wiring and hardwiring and doing. But one of the things is that essence that I see kind of is just problem solving. Okay, so as a human species, we've always been somebody in search of problem solving. Can you explore how individuals tackle difficult problems? And what are some of the common pitfalls that people face when trying to solve complex problems on their own?
Well, in writing this book, the first chapter, which I really had to open with because it's such a fundamental mental model that I think if you don't see it this way, it's hard to make sense of a lot of the other learning research. But this was a model created by Alan Newell and Herbert Simon in the 1970s, where they published this landmark book called Human Problem Solving. And basically, they redefined what problem solving means. They sort of took the study of it and said that what it means to solve problems by looking at tons of people solving problems is that we create something they call a problem space. Now, a problem space is a bit of an abstract idea, but the idea is that it's essentially all the moves you can do to go from the start to the finish. So I like to analogize it to a maze. When you're in a maze, you know where you are, you know where you'd like to be, but you don't know exactly how to get there because there's, you know, you can go left or right. You can't go directly to the end point. Now, in a maze, the walls of the maze are kind of physical. It's a very tangible representation of a space, whereas you can think about problem spaces as being more abstract than that. So if you're trying to solve a Rubik's Cube, for instance, the space is not like the physical space of the cube, but the configurations, because every time you rotate it, you switch the problem into a different state. And so his idea, or their idea rather, was that when we're solving problems, we're trying to first construct a space. So we're trying to represent the problem in some way that we can make moves to solve it. And then we're using this sort of library of these are the different moves that I can make to get from A to point B. And what I think is relevant to take away from that is that there's two ways that we solve problems. One is using kind of generic problem solving methods. And these methods appear to be fairly universal. They're not something that we necessarily need to be taught. They're things that we kind of do almost instinctively. And they are things like hill climbing is one of them, which is where you just basically try to make it better. So if you're writing an essay, you keep making small edits to make the whole essay better until you get to a better essay. Or if Right. you're trying to get from point A to point B, you're just like try to get closer on the compass direction to that direction. But then the real way that we solve problems, and I think this is, I think, the real insight from their approach and what we've learned from there is that the real advantage we have as a human species is that we have all these things that call strong methods, which are basically tricks that we know for particular situations to move forward in the problem space. So solving a Rubik's Cube just through trial and error is almost impossible. There's so many configurations, there's no way you could do it. But if you learn the right method, you can solve a Rubik's Cube in under a minute. There's like tons of YouTube tutorials where people can do it. And so the idea here, and this is related to this C factor, is that when you are trying to solve a problem, the very first step you should do is how do people solve problems of this type? What are the experts doing that solve problems that are very similar to this? Because if you can build your knowledge, your creativity on top of what is already known about solving problems in this space, you're going to make much, much faster progress than if you're doing things through trial and error or through your weak methods that we talk about, you know, these generic processes for solving problems.
That's a good explanation. And I want to thank you for that, because I think, you know, when we're solving problems, starting the book off that way was a good way for people to get an idea. I think frequently we get stuck, right, sometimes. And you talk about how creativity and copying, and you assert that creativity begins with copying. Yeah. How can learners balance the act of copying as a form of learning without stifling their own creativity?
Right. Well, I mean, this is another. So first, we're talking about how when you solve problems, a lot of what you do to solve those problems comes from other people. So that's the first factor.
Right. You're copying.
Copying, yeah, in a broad sense. I mean, obviously, it takes understanding, it takes thinking. So I don't want to just say problem solving is just copying. But the idea of copying, this is something I think is very powerful, is that often we make this tension between true creativity, originality, and understanding and replicating the works of other people. Like, you know, there's someone who's being derivative and there's someone who's being original, and we put those in opposite poles. When really I like to think of them as a progressive continuum, that anyone who does anything really original has started off by understanding kind of the work that's already been done. There's very few people that enter a domain having zero experience and create a useful contribution. And part of this is because of what I just talked about, and this is why I had to introduce this problem solving thing, is that, you know, to solve a Rubik's Cube, for instance, if you know nothing about it, the amount of configurations is huge. Just trying things out by trial and error, you're never going to get them in the same place. Now, you might, with some intelligence, figure out the right way to solve a Rubik's Cube, but it's much easier to learn how someone else does it. And in this chapter here, where I talk about creativity comes from, creativity begins with copying. The idea here is that there's a lot of research showing that learning from worked examples, so this is someone else demonstrating how to do something, is a much faster method of learning than beginning with problem solving. And so in a lot of domains, from mathematics, and I talk about artistic instruction here as well, this sort of apprenticeship model of seeing someone do it, being able to fully understand, being able to do it the way they do it themselves is a foundation for doing original work. Like, kind of, you have to know the rules before you can break them. But like, having that foundation is the recipe for creativity, because once you're able to do that, creativity is often just making a few small changes to an established body of work. So instead of doing it this way, you do it another way, or you break this convention instead of sticking to it, rather than, you know, a complete reinvention, which, you know, you throw out all the rules and you start off with something completely from scratch.
Well, getting better at anything, what you're doing is kind of laying the ground rules in this book for getting better at anything. And I think that's what's important. In other words, if we go seek a new hobby of some type and we want to master it, there are ways we can do that. I've always told my wife that I've got a lot of grit and determination. And if I'm going to repair something around the house, first thing I do is go to YouTube to look for a channel where somebody's done it to see what's happening. And I mean, look, there's millions of people that do what I do, but still they can't repair it, right? Yeah. So when they're done, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, where do I go next? What you do is take the knowledge you have from things that you've already experienced, add it to what you saw in the video to actually do that. And that's where kind of the copying, like somebody says, well, I'll give you a shortcut to go do something or get better at it. And one of these things was you talked about in here was feedback utilization. And I think that's where this comes in, is because when I go to YouTube, I'm looking for feedback. I'm looking for like, oh, I was on the right path. You know, I just missed a couple of steps. Maybe I should go do this. So what would you say that some of the strategies you'd recommend for somebody to seek out to utilize feedback effectively, especially in the fields where feedback is not readily available? Now, that's not YouTube.
Yeah.
Because, you know, YouTube, you can say, I got this plumbing issue, and you're going to find 800 guys on there that have put something on about how to fix some plumbing issue, right? You following me?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you're saying this is not where it's readily available. So how do I get feedback loop in those areas?
Well, I mean, I think when we're talking about what your experiences were like repairing things and having the YouTube video, I think an important factor, which is, you know, related to feedback, but is I think even more fundamental, is that in order to be able to use that example, so you're talking about repairing something. Another example I can think of is that following an online recipe. How many times, like, if you're not a good cook and someone shows you a recipe online, you try to make it and it's just a disaster. And like, why? I followed the same steps, right? And part of it is that in order to be able to copy, in order to be able to make use of that, you have to come at it with some background knowledge. And so you already have background knowledge for repairing tons of other things. And so what you're doing is you are not only following the steps, but you're filling in the sort of implicit assumptions that they make in that thing. So even if they try to spell things out in the most minute detail possible, well, maybe your pipe isn't the same as the pipe that they had, or you don't have quite the same wrench, or, well, this thing actually got a little bit stuck, and should you try to force it open, or is that going to break something? These kinds of little difficulties you're filling in with your background knowledge repairing things. And so I think this is a big part. Again, it goes back to our problem-solving ability. Whenever we meet a new situation, we're always having kind of the union of our background knowledge and whatever knowledge is supplied by the situation, or in this case, you know, from additional instruction or additional advice from the outside. And so building up that background knowledge is huge. And that background knowledge, again, mostly comes from this earlier process of seeing other people and doing practice and getting feedback. Yeah, sorry.
Well, I was going to say something, you know, because I've had so many people provide me accolades about, you know, like my interview process for a podcast. And I really appreciate that, even though at this point I have to just accept it and say, well, I can always be better. There's something I could do that was better. And, you know, you talk about mastery and teaching. Now, one of the things people have asked me to do is like, okay, can you teach me how you did those 1100 podcasts, right? And what did you learn? But what I really get out of these podcasts is I get the knowledge and expertise of somebody like Scott H. Young. And where I really do is I apply what I learn from you. Now, most people say, well, you're doing that because, you know, Scott wants to sell another book. And I say, Yeah, I like to help authors sell books, but at the same time, I'm very curious. And that's the other thing. Curiosity is a huge element. And so, without, detaining any longer, how do you teach to deepen understanding that leads to, one's greater learning, right? In other words, just their blossoming of their learning. And there's got to be an element here, Scott, where curiosity just has to be a huge element of somebody wanting to dig in here and learn and learn and learn and become better and better and better so that they hone this skill and master the skill, right? Ultra learning.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Like, to me, curiosity is an issue of motivation. Like, what motivates people to learn things? What motivates people to improve? And I actually wrote a sort of a research-oriented article on my website because I was very interested in this question of motivation. Like, what motivates people? What motivates people to learn? What holds people back? Like, why is there some people in the class that are just like eager to soak up knowledge, and other people are like, this is so boring. You know, it's so boring to some people. Well, why is it boring to some people, right? And so I wrote this complete guide to motivation. It's free on my website. If you Google Scotty Chung complete guide to motivation, you don't have to buy anything. It's a almost book length essay on the research on motivation. And there's a couple things that come up, and I think they're relevant. So one of them related to curiosity, and I think this is fascinating, is that curiosity tends to be a kind of perverse sort of motivation, because most of our motivations are kind of drive-like motivations, that you have a drive for something and then you get something that satiates it. So when you're hungry, you eat some food and then you're less hungry, and then the motivation goes down. Or you're thirsty and then you drink some water and you're less thirsty. And a lot of motivations work that way, right? They're homeostatic. Curiosity seems to be almost the opposite, that you're more curious about things you know more about. And that can seem paradoxical because obviously, you know, if there's 100 facts about something and you know zero, you know less than someone who knows 99. But that's just really not how knowledge works. That the issue is that when you don't know anything about something, it's also impossible for you to formulate good questions about it. When you know more about it, then you can ask good questions. And so one of my real joys has been like diving into the research where researchers can formulate questions that they're just not even articulable to someone who doesn't have a depth of knowledge in the field, because you don't even understand what the question is asking. But once you have that knowledge, you can be like, oh, that is a really interesting question. Why does that work that way? Or why is it this way and not that way? And that can drive people for their entire career. So I think the first ingredient to curiosity is kind of somewhat paradoxically to start learning more. When you read more books, when you have a greater understanding, more questions come up that fuels that curiosity. The second thing
I'll add in there, read more books and listen to more podcasts.
Even better, you get to have these conversations and listen to them as well. The second thing that I think is important, and I cover it in this book in the third, fourth chapter, the third maxim, is this idea of self-efficacy. So the psychologist Albert Bandura pioneered this concept, and it's basically the idea that to be motivated to do something, it doesn't just have to be the case that the outcome is something you find rewarding or valuable, but also you have to feel like you can successfully take the actions necessary to achieve that outcome. And that's pretty obvious, but it does mean that there is a certain self-reflexive quality to motivation, that when you are motivated to do something and you know how to do it, and you get a bit of practice and you get better at it, and then you feel more motivated to do it because you're more confident that you'll achieve the outcome the next time you do it. Whereas if you try it and you fail, or you try it and you don't know how to do it, no one's shown you how to do it, then you get stuck and you experience failure. And you know what? That outcome is out of my grasp. I'm not going to be able to understand this book, even if I do try to read it, or I'm not going to be able to learn this skill, even if I do practice it for 2 months. And when you have those beliefs, they become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I think self-efficacy is another huge part. I mean, part of my journey in learning how to learn was really, you know, taking some of these projects, happening to get some success with them, and those fueling motivation to try new projects and try new projects. If it had been the case that, you know, those first early projects I did were just total disasters, maybe I'd be like, ah, you know what, this whole learning thing, this devoting my life to, maybe I'm going to work on something else that's a little bit more tractable for me. So I think building success, building that base of knowledge, that background knowledge, all the things that we talked about, they're really self-reinforcing cycles. So you get more curious by learning more, and you build this motivation to learn by learning more. So it's really something, if you start making that investment in 10, 20 years down the road, you're going to be, you know, like yourself, 1,100 podcasts in and 10 or more.
I think you get an insatiable appetite for, even if the peripheral, I'm going to call it peripheral knowledge, mm-hmm. right? People can say, well, I'm not a master at anything, right? But I have this broad background through a lot of things. But you can connect the dots, right? And you learn how to connect dots better the broader and more expansive your education is. Now, I'm not saying that you don't become a specialist at something and maybe become a neurosurgeon and learn everything you want to learn about neurosurgery and how it works and what you want to do. But you did say in the book, improvement is not a straight line.
Yeah.
And what advice do you have for the learners and listeners who feel discouraged? You just said it a second ago. You get discouraged and you go, yeah, I'm going to kick the can and forget that one because I'm not going to be able to do anything about it. By plateaus in skills development. I've gotten hooked lately on Peter Attia. Okay. So Peter does a podcast around, he has a new book called Outlive Longevity. And he's really, you know, all the way down to muscle testing. And I mean, you want to get into the nitty gritty of glucose and how your glucose is doing and what's happening. And I think that, you know, somebody that's that driven, like Dr. Peter Attia, to want to understand both the physical, emotional, spiritual, psychological elements of how our body works is cool. You know, some people call him crazy, right? On the other hand, he's gotten to plateaus and even admits it. But he had to force himself to dig deeper or find another person who knew more about it than him, right?
Yeah.
So my question is, what would you tell somebody right now who's maybe hit that plateau and maybe is a little discouraged?
I mean, I think plateaus happen for all sorts of reasons. So I think, you know, what you're talking about, you know, there's a lot of areas of life where there are diminishing returns to things. You know, if I am trying to get in shape, for instance, and I have, you know, never exercised ever, and I'm like completely out of shape, even doing something like, you know, just keeping a step count and walking a little bit or, you know, doing a little bit of jogging is probably going to have enormous health benefits. Whereas if I'm already, you know, an ultra marathoner, and then, you know, to just get that little tiny bit of extra fitness could be quite a bit of work. And I think that's normal. So in that sense, it's kind of a plateau, just because once you've already gotten to 99%, getting that last 1% or another 0.1% is, you know, maybe as much work as going from 40 to 50%. That's just how progress works in a lot of domains. But in this book, and what I talk about in particular, is that there is a common pattern for a lot of skills that when you keep doing them, when you keep practicing them over and over again, what you're doing is you're making the sort of procedures, the sort of mental tools that you have for performing that skill more and more automatic. You're making them easier and easier to apply. Like you're kind of more deeply and deeply ingraining those habits of thinking, those ways of doing things. And that has two effects. One effect is it makes it easier and easier for you to perform the skill. So if you think about something like driving a car, for instance, it's something that was maybe excruciatingly difficult the first time you were doing it. You're like, okay, where do I put my hands? And like, how much do I turn the steering wheel and pump the brakes and this kind of thing, to where you can just do it so automatically that you end up driving somewhere you didn't want to because you got distracted and you just went on your normal commute, but you had to turn off in a different place. You weren't even thinking about it. That happened.
Or you just turn the autopilot on your Tesla and let it drive.
No, but I mean, even if you're listening to this podcast right now, maybe at this point you're like, oh, I missed my turnoff because I was listening to what he was saying and I wasn't paying attention. So this is a common tendency of the skills. But what it means is that, like, I am a very automatic driver. I drove here this morning. I wasn't really thinking about driving. But am I a really good driver? No, probably not. There's probably a lot better I could be as a driver. And part of the difficulty is that because you find some way to do something, even if it's not the best, and it becomes more and more ingrained, more automatic, that learning, that getting better at some point requires a kind of an active effort to, in some ways, unlearn, to like take an old habit and resurface it and make it better. And this can be difficult. This can be challenging. I talk about the research of Anders Ericsson, which was all about how, you know, elite performers are constantly doing this. They're constantly finding some aspect of their performance that's good enough, that's been good enough for years, that's something that an outside person who's not an expert probably wouldn't even care about, and trying to rebuild it, tweak it to make it better so that they can reach a new level of performance. And so
it's interesting. It's interesting you say that, because I was speaking with my wife, and she's been a piano teacher and a flute teacher, saxophone teacher for many years for kids and adults. And somebody asked her, they said, well, do we have to know anything about playing the piano? And she says, I'd rather that you came to me as a clean slate with nothing, because the reality is learning an instrument like that, when you have to have hand-eye coordination, you have to be able to read music, you have to have foot pedal coordination. You know, there's been many papers written about it. It's a very challenging instrument to learn, right? So she said she really likes to find the people that, where their minds haven't been bent in a different direction.
Right? Yes. Exactly.
Right. So to learn it. Well, we've given a little bit of time to technology and how AI maybe, or the internet, is going to affect it. What do you see in the near future or far future that the role of this is going to play in human learning, changing our lives over the next decades? Because where we are now is people like you, like me, thousands, we can put up a course and, you know, 10 lesson course, and we just push buttons and we listen to videos, and then there's some worksheets, or we have interactive trainings or whatever it is we're doing. It seems to be it's getting more and more immersive. Now, I would think with AI, that AI is really going to change the game of learning, especially in learning modules, where, hey, it's Scott and Cal talking about XYZ. Oh, by the way, here's the AI. You can just ask it a question, and it's already going to be able to respond back to us.
Yeah.
And Cal and Scott don't have to sit there and ask it, you know, to respond.
It's very interesting. You know, I have a lot of thoughts about technology and learning. And I think one thing you can say as a sort of an overall trend of learning research in ed tech, maybe over the last few decades, is that often there's been like some new technology that's heralded as like, this is going to transform education, and it often doesn't. And part of that, I think, is the fact that despite these advances in AI, despite these advances in internet and technology and stuff, for the average person, the average student, learning just remains such an important like human social relationship. So we can definitely make apps these days that would teach kids the basics of how to read, but the app itself is not going to force them to sit down and do the kind of cognitive work of learning these skills. And to that, they need the peers, they need the teacher, they need the social environment to create that. So in some ways, I think, you know, I talk about this in Ultra Learning, that, you know, the future really belongs to people who are able to have the self-regulation skills to like teach themselves things, to be able to like, okay, I want to learn this subject. And they're able to use these tools. They're able to use AI. They're able to use these things to get themselves to learn. And I think the kind of, I don't know whether it's a tragedy, but the difficulty of that is just that for a lot of people, they're still going to be reliant on this social environment. So it remains to be seen what AI is going to be able to add in those environments, just because I think so much of human learning is so intrinsically social that, not that we're not like cognitively able to learn from the AI tutor, but whether we are going to be motivated to like sit in front of a computer and prompt and text it all day to give us our questions. The second thing that I think is important, and I think is also relevant to our question of like this substitution and new vistas of cognitive skill, is that because these large language models are so trained on the text corpus, like book knowledge, basically, I think that's going to make an increasing premium on the kind of difficult to write down expert knowledge that tends to be encoded in practices, in people's, you know, intuition and wisdom of the field, this kind of like hands-on knowledge that is often, you know, it's just in the mind of some person who's an expert at this. And so I think in some ways it's going to make us even more reliant on social networks, on the kind of facilitation of learning from other people, because, you know, the kind of, you can just type it down and write it down. There's going to be a large language model that's going to learn how to do that at some point because there's detailed instructions for it. Whereas the, you know, difficult to describe how-to knowledge that, you know, you learn from observation and practice is going to remain kind of opaque to that kind of machine learning model.
It's interesting as with this dialogue has progressed with you, and we come to this point where I want to wrap up and give the listeners, because you call them the 12 maxims for mastery.
Right.
And it makes me reflect back on George Leonard's interview. George was one of the founders with another gentleman of Esalen, which is in Northern California here. And it's I don't want to call it experiential learning kind of series. And his book about mastery was really fascinating. And the many things that he did repeat at that time, because this book is quite old, but yet it's one of those things that you say 12 maxims for mastery. And it's mastery that he really honed in on of the practice of something on a regular basis, whether it was swimming, cycling, a teacher, playing the piano. And I think you'll find a lot of this come back to practice. What are if you were to leave our listeners with some of these maxims that you'd really want to drive home and say, okay, guys, these are the things that I think would really help you in accelerating your learning for something very hard, mastering a very hard skill. What would be those three things that you would promise them from this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would try to promise people, and each of the maxims, the way I kind of organized them was that this was a sort of central concept, a central idea that if you understood it, it would give you some keys to unlocking learning or improvement in your own life. So they're all built on kind of an established body of research around a particular idea in learning. So, you know, we've talked about a couple of them. So the first one was problem solving as search, is about this like really fundamental idea of like, how do people solve problems? Why are some problems impossible to solve? Why are some problems very difficult? How can we get better at solving problems? And then the creativity begins with copying is about cognitive load theory, but also this idea of, you know, learning from examples, learning from this sort of demonstrations of other people. You know, each of them covers, in a sense, their own little world, their own little, you know, I could have written an entire book about each of them, about these ideas related to learning, related to mastery. I think if I were to give people kind of the what I think they would get from the book, what I think would be most valuable to them, I think probably the idea of the see-do feedback loop. This is the idea of combining seeing from other people, getting practice on, and getting feedback. This is a common element in many, many successful learning systems. And getting that feedback loop right, getting those three elements right, is a huge part about making progress. The second thing is what I was talking about, alluding to before, is this idea of finding the right level of difficulty. You know, we talked about, you know, you're able to fix something that maybe other people aren't able to fix by watching a YouTube video because of this merger with your background knowledge and the knowledge that's present in the situation. And so a lot of learning is about finding that sweet spot where you have enough background knowledge, you have enough skill to be able to make gains, to make progress. If it's too hard, you're not going to be able to acquire new knowledge. If it's too easy, you're not going to grow. And then the final thing, I think, which is related to the emotions, the motivations of it. We talked a little bit about self-efficacy, about how building from success builds that curiosity, creates this sort of flywheel that keeps going and going. And I talk about at the end of the chapter about how fears and anxieties are also related on a similar principle, that as we get exposure to things, our own negative emotions surrounding something reduce as well. So I think diving deeper into that research, understanding those principles, I think could be helpful for someone in unlocking, you know, whether it's a barrier to getting better at something or just to give them the confidence to try something new.
Well, Scott, it's always a pleasure having you on Inside Personal Growth.
And thank you.
This book's going to be a huge success, I can tell you, because, you know, when you look at our work world today, and how diverse people have to be to maintain and sustain what I could say any vocation, because they're all expanding, particularly people that are in the programming world, like you have familiarity with, authors, entrepreneurs, visionaries of any type. They're being thrown so many things on a regular basis every day, and they're trying to get better at fundamentally coming up with a response or a solution or an idea or being creative or do something. And it's become, I want to say, relatively exponential in a lot of people's lives. Not everybody, of course, but probably for many of the people that would read your book, this is an area where they are going to say, hey, yeah, I got some really great ideas from how to get better at anything, right? And fundamentally, it's coming down to how quickly can we learn and how quickly can we draw from the resource pool up here, the resource pool on the computer, and the resource pool through other people that we can rely on, mentors, other folks we can talk to get feedback. You can take all three of those, put them together, and usually come up with a pretty good understanding of the decision you might want to make about something or the way you might want to go. I know when I go out and seek a new project, I'm usually looking at all those sources to fundamentally get an understanding and groundwork for it. But you've given us a tool, a really good tool, your book, Get Better at Anything. I'd also tell for all my listeners, we're going to have a link to Ultra Learning. Ultra Learning was one of the predecessor books, but you have how many books out now?
Well, these are the two I've published with traditional publishers, but I also have four self-published books that predated by a number.
So just go to Amazon. We'll put a link to it. Also go to Scott H. Young. There you'll see articles, challenges, products, podcasts. You've got a plethora of things that you can and sign up for. You can also get, you can sign up. I will say for those of you looking at this, and I'm sure it'll be taken down by then, but there was going to be some bonuses for pre-ordering the book, but this podcast is going to come out after that. So you won't be able to get those bonuses anymore. But I want to thank you for being on the show and sharing your ideas, Scott. It's always a pleasure having you on. And it was wonderful. And again, we'll put a link to Life of Focus, the actual course that Scott does, which you said is it a year long? 3 months long?
How long? 3 months.
3 months.
Yeah, this is a course we do with Cal Newport. So if you like his work too, talking about deep work, digital minimalism, he just released Slow Productivity. It really builds on a lot of those ideas, which are obviously consonant with things that I talk about and Get Better at Anything.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being on Inside Personal Growth and sharing it. Have a wonderful rest of your day in Vancouver. And I appreciate you being on the show.
Oh, yeah. Great. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this podcast on Inside Personal Growth. We appreciate your support. And for more information about new podcasts, please go to insidepersonalgrowth.com or any of your favorite channels to listen to our podcast. Thanks again and have a wonderful day.